Well, thanks very much. I didn't edit that, by the way. It's my office has got people to say nice things. So look, I'm going to start by welcoming you to Bristol Beacon. And just to say just how appropriate we think this venue is for my very last State of the City, because the building captures so many of the complexities and contradictions that is Bristol. I am a black mixed-race mayor descended from enslaved Africans, the great-great-great-grandson of Samuel Richardson, who was hung by the British in 1865 for participating in the Moreant Bay Rebellion. I am of working-class stock, an Irish migrant who settled in South Wales, my Welsh grandfather, and then the Breyer family in Bristol. And yet I stand here as mayor of a city with a history of entrenched inequalities and one which prospered and expanded through the profits of slavery. And this building was renamed from the wealthy slaver Colston, and that renaming happened on my watch. And the city reaction has been mixed. Some who have said they will always call it the Colston Hall and will never come to the Bristol Beacon. And then we've had others who refused to come to the building when it was called Colston Hall. And you know what? They're all Bristolians. And it was a key building, deteriorating in the middle of the city when I came to office. I was faced with its closure, and I agreed to proceed with its renovation. And then we faced three major decision points on the journey where the costs increased. Original cost plan was at £39 million. Then it came back as £50 million, with a £20 million contingencies. More complexities were uncovered as it went forward, and it became a £100 million project. And as is in all the headlines, ultimately a £130 million project. And yet at every stage, every decision-making point, the financially sensible thing to do was to proceed, not just because of sunk costs, but because of the positive impact the venue would have on the city. And there's a broader framework to this, that our decision was not just about getting this world-class music venue in Bristol. Remember, it was also about getting rid of a liability, a building in the middle of a city that was closed, derelict, and deteriorating, dragging the culture and economic strength of this part of Bristol down. And all those complexities about my relationship with the city and this building are echoed throughout the city's narratives and decisions we've had to make. So I have 49 days to go, and I will say it's been a real honour to be the Mayor of Bristol. And I just want to remind us, as David has thrown forward to, we have been on an incredible journey together as a city. So let's remember some more of what we've overcome since 2016. As David said, it's been a time of national political chaos. We've had austerity, the biggest squeeze on local government finance in history, bankrupting several councils, including two of the UK's biggest cities. Internationally, we've had the economic and social harm caused by Brexit. We had the global pandemic, the war in Europe, and rampant inflation, resulting in the cost of living crisis itself, increasing need and demand for public services while pushing up the costs of providing those services. We've had a series of migration crises, and we've had a growing understanding and respect for the climate and ecological emergencies. Across wider politics, we've faced the surge of political populism, the blessing and the curse of social media, and the rise of fake news, and a record decline of trust in politics. And throughout this, we've operated in the world's most centralised democracy, where cities like Bristol control just about 5% of their revenue. And the money we do get from national government remains subject to competitive bidding rounds. It's short-term and it's unpredictable. And all of those challenges are laid on top of Bristol's underlying persistent challenges. A city that the Resolution Foundation suggested was one of the worst cities in the UK in which to be born poor. An unequal city fractured along race and class lines. And a city with the worst affordability ratio of all major cities outside London. But in the face of all that, you know what? We're still standing. And more than this, we as a city have delivered. From housing to climate change to employment, we have delivered. So the record of our time here with my administration has been led by a mantra of homes, hunger, and hope. On homes, 14,500 homes would have been built since 2016, including many affordable and social. More houses and more affordable homes will be built in the city this year than in any year since 2004, when the Labour government was pushing, supporting cities to build. We have the biggest council house building programme in a generation. With private sector partners, we have delivered the ambulance station site, Wapping Wharf, the paintworks, Hartcliffe Campus, the Launchpad housing scheme. We have houses being built in some of the most deprived areas in the city, in Southmead at Elderbury Walk. In Henbury, we're building council houses in Richardson Close as we build in Alderman's Moor in Ashton Vale. In Lockleys, we have 185 homes in Bonington Walk and 268 homes in Romney House being built by our own council-owned company, Gorham Homes. The Western Harbour Master Planners were appointed this week, and we will deliver on other major infrastructure and housing projects from St Philip's Marsh and Froome Gateway alongside Temple Quarter, which includes the £500 million University of Bristol campus, the £350 million Temple Island development, and a £100 million redevelopment of Temple Meads station. And we will develop the St James area of the city. And this started last week with the agreement to build on the Premier Inn site, turning it into iconic towers in the city centre, as well as representing the shift to modern high-density co-living. On hunger, we have 22,000 children in the city who are eligible for free school meals. In a financial year 2023-24 alone, we issued £4.5 million of worth of vouchers for those children during the school holidays. Since the start of 2021, we've issued 435,000 vouchers, totaling £13 million. And on hope, through the Bristol Works programme and the commitment of city employers, we have provided 30,000 meaningful experiences of work for young people who would not normally have access to quality work experience. We've tackled the infrastructure challenges that have been ignored in the city for decades, including restoring the harbour walls and the sluice gates. Our bridges are being renovated. The chocolate path has been restored. And our road networks, despite what you might read, are being maintained. And we have increased funding for potholes. And with our city partner now, YTL, we are seeing delivery of the fourth biggest arena in the UK. And importantly, the most sustainable arena in Europe. And on the very nature of our leadership, we have honoured the 50-50 campaign, with half of the cabinet since 2016 being women, amongst the most diverse political leadership the city has ever known. On transport, we have pedestrianised the old city of Corn Street and King Street. We've introduced bus gates and our public transport prioritisation through the city centre. Other areas of pedestrianisation like Cotton Hill and Clifton Village are supporting traders, and we have increased dedicated cycle lanes through a £720,000 worth of investment in a new cycle scheme through Old Market. We've offered free electric bike loans and cycle training and are installing cycle hangers across the city. And we brought the scooters to Bristol. Some love them. Lots of people love them. Some people on Facebook don't, but hey, what are you going to do? You know, we kept our manifesto commitments, including keeping all of our children's centres and library open. We supported the Creative Centre. Remember, Channel 4 are now in Bristol. And we introduced the Agent of Change to Bristol to protect music venues in the city. And on climate change, have you heard, we launched a world first with Bristol City Leap, which ensures £1 billion of investment into our decarbonisation. And this is on top of the £100 million already invested in decarbonisation work since 2016. Now, our City Leap deal means that £771 million will be invested to cut energy bills, create green jobs, and cut carbon emissions by 150,000 tonnes by 2029. We've planted over 95,000 trees since 2016 and contributed to a deal with Ambition Lance Weston that erected the tallest onshore wind turbine in England, at a time national government opposed onshore wind turbines. And all of this will contribute heavily to our One City goal of becoming carbon neutral by 2030. We cleaned up our air with a clean air zone, but it's not the clean air zone alone that we should be celebrating. It's the £40 million package of support we secured from government to mitigate its impacts on business and households in the city. And this money includes support for people to change their vehicles, includes free bus tickets, discounts on car club membership, and £2 million for clean buses. And that's not near anywhere a comprehensive list of what we've done. There's so much more, but you don't want to hear me listing all evening. So I'll share that it's also been a journey for me as a real person, as you can see, in leadership in the city. And sometimes it feels like people don't think, I and others in public leadership are real people. But I'll share with you that in 2012, I was on a stage in the offices of Burgess Salmon at my first mayoral hustings. And I was on stage, and I'm going to give you some brutal descriptions, with three white men in their 60s and 70s. And as I looked out across the audience, I saw two people I thought I could be mayor. One was my mum, and the other was her friend. And I didn't think anyone was looking at that stage and saying, that 6 foot shaved-headed black guy on the end, he looks like the mayor of Bristol. Now, I call this a kind of a justified projection, because I didn't actually think I looked like a mayor. And I was projecting that onto the crowd myself, perhaps somewhat unfairly, but I also think there was some justification in it. And I'll tell you this story. David Cameron came to Bristol promoting the mayoral model in 2011. And there was a journalist there, a very well-known political journalist in the city. And he sought out interviewees after Cameron's talk, interviewed a number of people. And then just about to interview me, Cameron came off stage. He said, Marv, I'll be back in a minute. I waited, the room emptied out, and I was thinking, oh, well, I've got to get myself on TV. And he come back and just said, Marv, ain't got time to interview you, sorry. And that, to me, was a message that you're not even worth interviewing when we're talking about this mayoral system right now, 2011. And most of you won't know this, some will, but even when I did win, it took me 5 or 6 months before I was comfortable to introduce myself as the mayor. Now, being the mayor, as I describe it, is being like, it's been like putting on a suit jacket that was too big for you. And then one day you wake up and you realize you've actually grown into it. So I went from an outsider to standing up at the State of the City, giving that speech in 2016. And at that event, my mum and her best friend Jean were in the front row. And breaking away from my script, I said, Mum, who would have thought? So my journey has now taken me and my mum, my wife Kirsten, my sister, last week to Windsor Castle, where I received my OBE. And we've... No, don't worry. And actually, even just walking around, Windsor was, how did we end up here, right? And I will say that we've had a series of young people through my office over the years. It's quite a regular thing. And I do share, and other people in my office who've had similar journeys, Kevin, my chief of staff, share this kind of journey with them. And we advise them, be ambitious, even if your confidence struggles to keep up with your ambition. Now, I experienced my relationship with Bristol, and I would say Bristol's relationship with me, through the prism of race and class. Now, it's the framework through which I've experienced our city's social structures, its journalism, dangerous for me to say that, and its activism. Now, I respect other people will experience their relationships with Bristol in other ways, but my own experience is dominated. The race and class elements have dominated my experiences with the city. And in that context, becoming and being mayor has been a journey, actually, of healing with my relationship with Bristol. And I'll share another story with you. It's about 1987. Myself and four friends, Dean, Marcus, Mark and Jason, went to a party in a church, youth club, at Zion Chapel on Coronation Road. Now, we knew we were in the wrong part of town. We were 15-year-old black teenagers. We'd gone south of the river. And afterwards, we were walking home, and we got to the bottom of Redcliffe Hill, and a group of about a dozen older white men started shouting racial abuse at us. I said hello, I literally did say, all right, mate. And then they said, get them. And then they chased us. And I have no doubt, for those of you that know Bristol's reputation for violence in the 1980s, that if they'd have caught us, we'd have been in very serious trouble. That kind of sense of physical threat and abuse was not unusual growing up in Bristol in the 80s. And for my forebears, my elders, who had to deal with that in the 60s and 70s, it would have been worse. And then throw forward to 2012, and this is a story of healing. I'm in Lawrence Weston, campaigning to be mayor. I knock on a door. It opens, and a big guy, a white guy, opens the door. Tattooed arms, shaved head. My early warning kicked in, and I presumed the worst. And you know what he said to me? I'm voting for you. You're one of us. And I will share that my experience in the city through race and class, through that prism, has left me with a number of interesting reflections. And one is a sense of belief in the authenticity of some members of the Merchant Venturers that is greater than that I've seen in some of the noisiest anti-racist and social justice activists in the city. And it's left me with a feeling, a greater sense of connection with some of the Cenotaph counter-protesters than I did with the Colston Four. Now, I stress feeling because that reaction, my journey around race and class, it's not something I've chosen. It's natural and it's been involuntary, a product of a shared story within the city. Now, when we came into office, we came in with a commitment to get things done. Now, the truth is that delivery is a tightrope for politicians, because when you deliver, it means making changes. And when you make changes, it means political conflict. And there is a path of least resistance open to politics that says do little and avoid controversy. Stay away from housing delivery. Stay away from big transport solutions. Focus on making announcements, pushing gimmicks, exploiting photo opportunities, then blame the government and other outside forces for ongoing social challenges. But that serves the politician rather than the people we came in to make a difference for. I'll give you an example of this. Plimsoll Bridge, the swing bridge over the Cumberland Basin, was brought to me in that it was at end of life. We were told it would cost £40 million to fix. But rather than spending £40 million just to keep the bridge as it was, we saw an opportunity to repurpose that £40 million and ignite the regeneration of the harbourside, including 2,000 homes and the introduction of modern flood defences at the same time. The result was the Western Harbour Vision, a brownfield site development converted to homes that are a 7-minute bike ride and a 25-minute walk from the city centre, rather than a spare piece of land dominated by a road flyover. And I thought the plan would be welcomed, and I was wrong. I was invited to Holy Trinity Church Hall with residents from the area. I'd say there were at least 300 people inside, with others locked out, unable to get in. The overwhelming mood was anger. I stood on stage by myself as some people asked very legitimate questions and others accused me of all sorts. And after an hour of listening, then it was my turn to speak. But my entry point is not to enter into the dispute, but to say this. Before focusing on the point of disagreement and making assumptions about my motivations, why don't we as a collection of people move upstream and see if we can agree on some fundamental truths about the Bristol we are living in? And I offered these fundamentals into that discussion. We are 42 square miles and we're not getting any more land. We have a residential population of around 476,000 people, which is expected to grow to 550,000 by 2050. We have more than 22,000 people on our housing waiting list today, with over 1,500 families in temporary accommodation. We have to solve the housing crisis in the context of a climate and ecological emergency, which means prioritising high-density development on brownfield land in the heart of cities where people don't need cars. The questions remain, as I shared, do we agree we need to solve the housing crisis? Do we agree that if we build homes, they actually have to be put somewhere. Do we agree that brownfield sites in the middle of the city are better than greenfield locations that build in car dependency? Now, I've said many times, I'm happy for people to say no at any point in that sequence of questions, as long as they own the consequences of that no. And I think repeatedly, if we could just, as a city, agree on the nature of Bristol and the nature of challenges and the limitations on options that are available to us to meet those challenges, our city conversations about some of the biggest controversies would be much more constructive and pragmatic than destructive and conspiratorial. I'll add to the list of Bristol's fundamentals that 1 in 5 of our children live in low-income households. We are one of the worst cities for racial inequality. We are an unequal city in which almost 100% of Clifton teenagers progress to university compared to 1 in 12 in Hartcliffe. Almost 10% of our households experience fuel poverty and 4% experience food insecurity. There's a gap in healthy years life expectancy of over 16 years between the richest and poorest areas in Bristol. It's important we understand and respect the raw material of Bristol as the framework for our debates about priorities and the costs of action and, importantly, the costs of inaction. Sometimes it seems as though we're dealing with different Bristols. Some of the argument and accusation that's come at us over the years seems to be grounded in a Bristol that doesn't seem to be facing a housing crisis and a transport crisis. It doesn't have a rapidly growing population. It has an infinite land supply. It has a city council that is not limited by austerity, and it can deliver decarbonisation through political will alone without the need to raise billions of pounds to pay for it. And it has the time to prioritise declarations of principles before the need to actually get things done. The failure to ground ourselves in the same Bristol and a failure to work within the discipline of the same truths opens us up to conflicts that are more often noisy than they are useful. And it leaves us with a shallow and self-centred framework through which we misinterpret, sometimes accidentally, sometimes intentionally, the motives of others. And when we make decisions, we are, as a leadership, acutely aware of the following realities. We are facing multiple interacting crises that require action now. The longer we delay, the worse they will get, and the more intrusive and expensive the solution will be. Second, every action has a cost, but inaction also has a cost. And thirdly, and this is incredibly important, we go into a new political system, you will not get everything you want. And I'll add another element, by the way, to the raw material of Bristol, and that is our city culture. We are a city of contradictions. I've said this many times. And one of the contradictions is the way we combine being home to some of the nation's leading talent, being a thriving creative hub within the nation, with a high number of business startups, with a collective lack of self-belief that, when it's full-blown, turns into a debilitating cynicism. It is born of past failures, a historic inability to deliver big projects, an arena, transport solutions, homes, but it puts a handbrake on today's ambition. We've seen this clearly around mass transit. You know, we must solve the problem, and that simply must include underground where needed. The alternative is gridlock, or the inevitable failure to overcome the obstacles of trying to deliver a 100% overground system. The National Infrastructure Commission has backed our ambitious approach, recommending that we have a share of £20 billion, one of 4 cities to share from that £20 billion set aside to help us deliver mass transit. And it would have taken lots of work, but we are currently in danger of guaranteeing it won't happen because a number of local actors have failed to show the necessary ambition and commitment to work together. Now, compare this to the culture we managed to build around Temple Quarter, where, because we came together around a bold ambition, we eventually secured the £95 million to renovate our train station. Throughout that course, We maintain support from Sir Ed Lister, Boris Johnson's chief of staff, Peter Handy, chair of Network Rail, the University of Bristol, Homes England, WECA, Combined Authority, and government ministers. And we stayed united, we stayed ambitious, and we stayed committed. And we got their money over the line. And as you look across St. Philip's Marsh now, the cranes are up. The warning to future leadership in Bristol is that coming up with motions, coming up with petitions and opinion pieces is the easy part. Working with a complex city to build a shared front, to raise the finance and work through the trade-offs is harder. But it's the other side of that that you find delivery. We've been unapologetically ambitious for Bristol. And when I came in, the political debate, believe it or not, was dominated by car parking and fun Sundays. Right? Today, the city talks about inclusion, homes and growth, £1 billion regeneration programmes, carbon reduction and a climate challenge, biodiversity, race and class, and building a city for the future. And from giving a TED talk at the Global TED Conference in Vancouver to launching 3CI to speaking on behalf of the Global Parliament at the Mayor's Migration Council at several UN conferences on migration and refugees, we as a city are also shaping national and international agendas. Along with the CEO of the Royal Society of Arts, Andy Haldane, I co-chaired the Urban Futures Commission. The report we produced is, dare I say, the plan for the UK cities, showing how we can unlock billions of pounds worth of productivity that is currently untapped. Bristol leaders need to take Bristol's hopes and potential seriously. The people of this city must be prioritised as people with real lives, not just votes to be harvested. We also need leaders who understand Bristol is a collective act. It is not just about the council. Bristol One City, as you heard today on the video, was the vehicle we set up to bring the city together. At the city gathering just last Friday, held here in Bristol Beacon, 300 people from across Bristol came together. We affirmed our city priorities, our focus on race and housing, the race and gender pay gaps, and tackling school exclusions. That is how we will maximise the chances of success. Collaboration is how we won Channel 4 to Bristol. It's how we got the money for Temple Quarter, and it's helped us deliver Bristol City Leap. It's how we got so many homes built and an arena on the way. We need to learn from this model. Now, we've put a pipeline of projects in place that will land over the coming decades and keep the momentum going in Bristol. Temple Quarter, the Debenhams site, the galleries, Western Harbour, Hengrove Park, Froome Gateway, Baltic Wharf, the Fruit Market, and in the Gorham Homes business plan, to that list, you can add, brings us to over 18,000 more homes on their way to be agreed, consented and built, if the city can keep delivering. We've delivered 8 balanced budgets, and the financial pressures will continue for local government. The future leadership will need to protect libraries, children's centres and the council tax reduction scheme. And the work will need to continue to transform the drivers of the increasing costs facing local government across adult social care and children's care, including special educational needs and home-to-school transport. This is all going to need a united city under a one-city approach. Now, leadership is a collective act, as I've said, so thanks are always due. If I start to mention specific names, it means I'm not mentioning others, so I'm playing it safe. I need to thank Bristol City Council's senior team. No one thanks local government. And the officers are often on the receiving end of ridicule. It's a blood sport within Bristol and more broadly. But our officers work incredibly hard, and I want to thank them. I want to thank my cabinet as well. Again, I have been in the room where I've watched cabinet members attacked on Twitter and social media by anonymous people, and I've watched my cabinet members agonise emotionally over the challenges that they face. And breaking the rule here, and I not to deprioritize other cabinet members just because they were deputy mayors, Craig Cheney and Asher Craig. Thank you for standing up and stepping in that gap, you know, as well, and taking particular, you know, attention. I want to thank our city partners, because we wouldn't get 300 people together unless they chose to be together. And they responded to the invitation to unite, and they've stayed the course. And I really thank them for coming together to help us get delivery from Bristol, be it tackling hunger, coming together through the pandemic. The success we've had is because the key institutions and sectors have willingly come together. I have to thank my office and the mayor's team. Maybe I shouldn't pull the curtain back on this, but one of my best friends, John, who's a partner at Thrings, he said to me, "What do you actually do, Marv?" And sometimes I say, "I don't know, John." I say stuff and people do stuff. And my office, dealing with the 1,500 to 2,000 emails that come in each week, filtering out some of the hate emails that come in, you know, chasing up people, driving, making a connection between the conversations and the political priorities we have and the organisation of Bristol City Council and our wider partnership, it could not be done without those who were there now and those who were there before. And the mark of how good they've been, by the way, is that how many of them have gone on to incredible, stellar careers after being in office. I need to say my personal thanks to my friends who have stood with me and, you know, and encouraged me, and obviously to my family, many of whom have sat at the front here. Can I just stand you up quickly, just to embarrass you? Come on. Mum, you have to stand up, Kirsten. It's my sisters, my nephews. Yeah. Of course, my sons didn't stand up. And they kill me for saying that later. But it does take a toll on a family, you know. And look, over the years, we've had threats to our house. You know, I've got the formal security. I've also got friends like Martin who I've said, "Martin, will you be on the end of the phone if something happens?" "We'll be there, Marv," when I've gone away. And that's not been easy, right? So thank you all for being with me. And I also want to just say, I'm going to pick out a name as well. I lost in 2012. I was talking with my wife, Kirsten, about going again in 2016. And Kirsten said, "Only if Kevin comes with you." And that's Kevin Slocum. And the story I've told about Kevin often, and I'll use it again. If any of you are West Wing fans, I'm going to bore everyone with this, but Bartlett is in the White House. He's going off to give his State of the City. There's a designated survivor, and there's a young representative. And he says to the young representative, "Do you have a best friend?" He says, "Yeah." He says, "He's smarter than you?" He says, "Yeah." He said, "You trust him with your life?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "There's your chief of staff." And this wouldn't be possible without Kevin being side by side. Either permission from Kirsten or the practicalities of being mayor. All right, stop clapping, Kevin. Now, listen, last bit now, I promise. Now, for the best part of 8 years, I've had on the wall in my office an extract from a speech by US President Teddy Roosevelt. I'm not saying he's a great human being, but this insight is powerful. And it's called The Man in the Arena, and I apologize, it is gendered, but I'm going to read it as it is, because I share this a lot with people that come into my office, and I'm going to read the whole extract now, and I want Bristol to really, for people to take this person, I often give it as a piece of advice. And it goes like this. "It is not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs, who comes short again and again, because there is no effort without error and shortcoming, but who does actually strive to do the deeds, who knows great enthusiasm, the great devotions, who spends himself on a worthy cause, who at the best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement, and who at worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly. so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who know neither victory or defeat. Thank you.
So, welcome back. We've got about 35 minutes for questions. There's questions from myself in a moderated conversation, and then some time at the end for questions from you, the audience. And we have some roving mics to pick those up. But because we're short of time, I'm going to get straight into it. And I'd like to sort of begin by taking you back 8 years to that day in 2016 when you became mayor. Could you just describe what was that like? What was daunting about that moment?
It was a range of emotions, actually. Surprisingly, the first emotion I had was one of embarrassment. Kelvin Blake, who was my agent, called, sent me, I got to get up to the park where the camp was being held. And as I walked in, because I think we had a sense that the votes had gone our way from the people looking at the counters, I thought everyone's looking at me. And I just wanted the world to swallow me up. You know, and at the same time, there was another emotion. And I talked about the frame, the prism through which I experienced Bristol. Listen, I'm not making any judgments about anyone, but I will just say how it was for me. When I'd lost in 12, there'd been this argument, you know, that there was this kind of anti-establishment thing going on, and I was being portrayed as a member of the establishment because I was with a political party. I was like, hold on. I'm running against privately educated, you know, people that were at university in the 60s. I'm really not the establishment. And actually, running as an independent is what you can do if you have lots of personal wealth or have access to personal wealth, because the unions and the Labour Party made it financially possible for me to mount a campaign. And that was being lost. And so I felt like I was mugged of my story. I shared this with Rob Mitchell, who made the film The Mayor's Race, you know, at the time. So when I won in 16, I felt quite... frustrated about that, but not just the loss, but the symbolism around it. Somehow the parties and the establishment have been defeated in the favour of independence and all that type of stuff. I thought, oh, this isn't... So when we won, it felt to me right. Not that I am right, but the symbolism of where I'd come from winning felt right.
To pick up on that, and to talk more about this prism through which you've experienced the city, it is... It's difficult to miss the symbolism of someone descended from enslaved people in a city from which 1,114 slave ships expeditions set sail. But you've also been very clear in a way that I think is sometimes not fully recognised that you're also half white British working class. We're living in an age when there is this false dichotomy that you either care about class or you care about race. How is your background, all aspects of it, how has that shaped your politics and shaped your time as mayor?
Well, a number of key ways. I share a couple of stories about my upbringing. So one is, like I said, it was not unusual, and by that I mean it was usual, to be racially abused on the street growing up as a kid. That was just normal. If we were walking down Russellton Avenue or straight onto Church Road, we're in the wrong part of town, someone would drive past and go, "Who are you?" this, that and the other, right? And then that could turn into a physical chase, physical threat. That was normal. But actually, as well, I was 13 years old, so it's about 1985. I was walking to school, and one of my black friends said to me, "So, Marv, in a war between black and white, whose side are you going to be on?" And that was about my mixedness and me having a white mum and a primary white caring family. Now, I didn't know how to answer that question at the time, so it was obviously kind of confusing. What I had to hold on to was a sense of self that I had from somewhere and a sense of purpose, and that I didn't want to just be roadman around, you know, around Eastern. So that kind of got me through. But that But my sense of being in racial limbo, being illegitimate, like born outside of marriage and all that, has left me with a qualified relationship with belonging. And again, when I was being charged with being a party man, I was like, I don't recognise your sense of belonging to a party without question. I don't belong to the Labour Party. It's a group of people who I have an affinity with because I think they ran the right issues. Any group, I just do not join it easy. And I do see the subtleties in that. When Colson's statue came down then, I ended up with a quote you ended your documentary with, again, which was that lots of things could be true at the same time. And what I said at the end was, you know, white privilege is real, right? This is the way the world is. But my white mum did not lead a life of privilege. And those two things are true at the same time. Not all white people lead the privileged lives. And I just wanted to hold that space, as difficult as it is to hold and as contradictory as it is. And I think that, in some sense, has come from my mixedness. I will say, by the way, when I was at Yale a few years ago, and I introduced myself. I was there with Alexei Navalny. We were in the same class. And I told that story of my growing-up mixedness. And it was a Lebanese woman called May Ackle said to me, "You just told a Lebanese story." And her mum is Jewish Lebanese, her father's Christian Lebanese. And she grew up across divides, navigating difference as well. And that had impacted, it had very similar impacts on her sense of identity, conflict, peace and reconciliation as well.
And do you think it's helped in a city that I talked earlier, and you talked very eloquently about the divisions in Bristol. Do you think it's helped you recognise those divisions and try to build bridges?
I certainly think it's been something for me. I've got all sorts of stuff coming in, but one of the things I can point out is, yeah, I'm descended from enslaved Africans. And again, when I found out that my great-great-great-grandfather had been hung by the British for the Moreton Bay Rebellion participation, I was like, wow, you know, this is my heritage, right? And yet, I look at my family with the Briars. That is a working-class family. I look at my grandfather growing up in South Wales, poor Welsh miner's son. I've got all those stories in me. And it's actually a story I did tell when I was at the... I don't know if you resonate with this. I've suggested that how we think about how we live with difference is in me, right? That when I recognise my Englishness, it does not take away from my Welshness. When I look at my Jamaicanness, it does not take away from my Welshness or my Englishness. And when I find out that my great-grandmother had come from Ireland, it just made me more me. They were not zero-sum components of my identity. And if we can scale that up onto society level, then we get beyond these silly, one-dimensional binary definitions of what it means to be long in any land mass area. And I think we urgently need that.
As a Nigerian Geordie living in Bristol, I can slightly empathise with that. I do want to labour the point, but another feature of your upbringing, which I think we're in a country at the moment with the most privately educated cabinet we've had for very, very many decades, another feature is being brought up in social housing and understanding the stress of housing and now having been mayor in a period when the housing crisis, we often use the word housing crisis, I think we underestimate and we understate this. This is one of the defining social crises of our nation in these decades, in the early first half of the 20th century. How has those experiences helped frame the priorities and the successes that you've had, that you've just articulated, when it's come to addressing this crisis? And Bristol's done well under your leadership, compared to other cities, in confronting the fact that we need homes.
And I would say, again, I've got experts around who know about the math of housing delivery, and it is about math, and have done incredible work on that front. So, yeah, I courted, accidentally, some real anger in the Labour Party and amongst some groups when I happened to suggest that we think more roundly about the drivers of social mobility. And I said that actually libraries were not part of my journey. And I wasn't justifying, I wasn't attacking libraries. I was just saying, if you want to think about how we liberate people from poverty, yes, libraries, but boxing, you know, teacher, for me, faith, and actually having a stable home, right? A house where we could shut the front door and feel somewhat safe inside was massively significant. And obviously I came through public health as well. And I think that a quality home that's affordable
and that's not just to live in, pay rent or buy, but to heat, is one of the single most significant policy interventions we can make in building a just society. I'll also just share this little story, David. You know, I referred to them earlier. We had the Colston statue pulled down a week after we had a there was a rally at the Cenotaph. Now, what I have shared the story more latterly. I knew it wasn't just a far-right event. It wasn't that simple. So I called up my cousin, who knew a few football lads, and I went to meet the organiser of the Cenotaph rally. I phoned him up, and he agreed to take a call, and he was at pains to say, I'm not far-right. Anyway, I ended up going around with Kevin and my cousin Simon, and we went round his house. This is a guy that phoned up five football firms and the Hells Angels, right? And they turned up in Bristol. So he's, you know, he's connected. He really liked... Well, he was a good guy. We talked policy, right? We talked about housing, we talked about hunger. He was all over that. He gave us a paper that he'd written on working class history with the football firm. It was a brilliant paper. You can't be a leader unless you're smart. And he did that. And then I said to him, tell me what's going on for the guys who turned up. He said, Marv, they feel like they're losing their city. And I said, they are losing it. But they're losing it to house prices, not to migration. He said, yeah, I know. And there's the thing, right? You look at that you know, the and actually, it wasn't even about race in that sense, even though it might get interpreted as race, and it may get co-opted by people who want to make it about race. But actually, they were quite angry at gentrification and what's happening to house prices in Bedminster. On top of that, by the way, then you put tearing down the Colston statue. I don't want a statue of a slave up in the middle of the city, but I need to understand the way people might see it. So we can't afford to live in a city we grew up in. And then suddenly you're ripping our culture away from us, right? All these outsiders coming. I can see the alignment and how that can create a situation where if people don't step in at that point in time and take control, could be co-opted by people of what I call political predators, right? The populists, you know, extremists. And so I see housing as, yeah, like you say, it is the critical issue at the moment, you know, in our country.
Just to talk about that summer, the company I was then running made a documentary with you because I knew you. It was an amazing moment. Bristol was all over the newspapers, all over the news, all over the world. And it was an observational documentary about how you managed that summer. And as you said, people were coming to Bristol with bad intent. Was that the most difficult moment being mayor of all of Bristol with that international glare, with that moment when, as you say, there were political predators seeking to exploit this moment, either for fame or for political gain?
Do you know, it's funny looking back on those moments because I kind of felt that at that period of time, I was most fully me because of the fullness of my identity and the track record. You know, there's a guy in your documentary, Nigel, from Hartcliffe.
Scaffolding guy.
Scaffolding guy. Nice stood guy. On top of the plinth, shirt off, Union Jacks, tattoos, kind of like what people would say was a symbol of kind of racism, but he's not, and he pointed out, you know, and his point was, listen, I grew up in Hartcliffe, I don't know what white privilege is, and I met him for a TV interview. Funny enough, when I met him for the, we did Sunday Politics, I think they were trying to set us off against each other, but he said to me, oh, I was down your boxing club. He said, I realise you're one of us. You know what I mean? It was nice. And actually, it wasn't just coming up with policy. I think at that moment in time, potentially with me and Kevin, other members of my team and cabinet, it was also about who was in leadership at that moment in time. So even with Nigel, I was able to say to him, listen, I said what I said about my mum. He said, I don't get this white privilege. I said, the thing is, Nigel, all other things being equal, white skin gives you an advantage, right? But I also recognise my white mum did not lead a privileged life. And it's true that lots of white people don't, and you didn't. And he said, oh, I understand. You know, it was a nice moment. It was a connected moment. And we made space to have a conversation in that moment. I wasn't trying to convert him. He was asking, and I shared back. I don't know. It's interesting. It's difficult to show what you prevented happening. But we didn't end up with the level of violence that they had in London, for example. And I think that, you know, I went and met some of the guys. I said, I want to know what's going on, and that was positive. And I was told that there was chat on some of the Facebook sites. Like, we met the mayor, and he's listening, he understands us. And the fact that maybe he was a black mixed-race guy who went to meet and listen and understand probably mattered, you know, as well, that they weren't just being forgotten and sidelined.
Those conversations that you've had where you've reached out to people in those dangerous moments, the big conversation, the arena in which we're supposed to discuss choices for our city, is supposed to come through journalism. And you've been quite clear that you've been critical of the political debate as it's emerged in Bristol through our local journalism, through some of the channels that we have. What are your frustrations about the debates and how they're framed?
Sure, my team will have their heart in their hands now.
Well, I think with 49 days left, you know.
Don't talk about the journalists. But you know, I can't not go over that hill. So this is my thought, and I'm not being angry, I'm not criticising, I'm just sharing a perspective. First off, I experienced the city through racing class. And I cannot fail to see a sector in the city that talks about the city, claims to represent the city, but doesn't employ us. Starting to write stories about black people is not employment. Right? It's harvesting stories from people, making yourself look and putting pictures in. But if you're serious, start giving jobs. And those jobs in local press are a pathway to national jobs as well. So when we talk about the underrepresentation and we look at the elitist Britain, the reports on social mobility, it's not unique. This politics is unrepresentative. The judiciary is unrepresentative. The legal sector, creative sector. But journalism is too.
And journalism is one of the worst.
Well, and I'm just saying...
The Sutton reports, other pieces of research have showed that creative and journalistic sectors are some of the worst offenders when it comes to inclusion and diversity.
And I'm going to humbly say this. A guy called Rupert asked me about my connectivity with the community. Yeah. And charged me, you've lost connection. And I was like, Rupert, what would you know? So... a little bit of self-awareness. That doesn't mean I can't be challenged and can't be asked questions, but a little bit of self-awareness. And maybe I'm on this too long. I recognise the challenge. I think the disinvestment in newsrooms is appalling at the local level. It leaves people without the time to investigate and explore and check for the nuance of a story. So if you've got to knock out 4 stories a day, do you have time to test the accusation given by one person to another? Or are you left in a situation where someone just says, hey, Marvin's rubbish, and they write 6 paragraphs saying Marvin's rubbish, and then say, Marvin, do you want to comment on what they said? And it's just like, quote, quote, Is that insight? And I think we also need to recognise the pressure on outlets to generate clicks to sell advertising. I don't think there's necessarily always the honesty that the measure is not always about truth and nuance and subtlety. It's how many people clicked on your story, because we've got advertising to sell. I think...
And setting up a council-owned housing company doesn't... There's no antagonism in that. There's no clickbait in that. That's a complicated story that needs reportage.
Oh, yeah. I didn't use the word clickbait. I'm just saying...
I'm using it.
So I hope that I've said that gently enough to say I think there are legitimate questions and challenges to be taken on to support the profession be what I believe it can be and needs to be if it's going to play the role, the essential role it has in sustaining meaningful debate, particularly as the challenges we face become bigger, the solutions become more expensive and more intrusive, and the trade-offs become more contentious. If we don't have the ability to have those debates, we will just be more vulnerable to predators who feed on grievances and then tell us what we want to hear.
I want to make sure I leave some time for questions at the end, but I would like to get to a couple more questions. You mentioned earlier an issue about confidence in Bristol, in the belief in big projects, in ambition for the city. I've got to say, as someone who came here 25 years ago and from the northeast, a place much, much poorer than Bristol or much of Bristol, I was surprised at the lack of civic infrastructure that I was used to in the northeast. How do we escape this problem, this feature of Bristol?
I it's really interesting. I really don't know, other than to drive on delivery and begin to build up that track record. So I'll share with you, David. You, I think, may have shared this at the beginning. I woke up in the morning a few years ago, and I read in a newsletter that Channel 4 was relocating. And the article was talking about Coventry going for Channel 4's new, one of their hubs or their head office. So I get in my office and I said, hey, Channel 4 moving, what are we doing? And the literal response I had was, yeah, we won't get it, so we haven't raised it. I said, you don't get to make that decision.
But we won't get it even though we have some of the most impressive television infrastructure, some of the greatest producers in the world in this city.
The default was, we will not get it. And everyone's talking about Birmingham, Manchester, and then actually it was Lynn Barlow who's here, Grant Mansfield, Fiona, who was running Bottle Yard at the time. We got together, we convened loads of creatives in City Hall, and we said, do we want to go for this? I will only go for it if you want to go for it. I'm not going to bid for it as Bristol City Council. They said yes, we bid, the rest is history. By the way, our bid cost £23,000-£24,000. I won't name the cities, but two other cities spent £250,000 on their bids and didn't get it. What we did, our bid was authentic. It was about connectivity, diversity, and we mobilised the community to support it, and they saw that unity. We launched we announced the mass transit system for the city, right? The plans to do it, and we started to work on it. I've just been shocked at just how people go out of their way just to say, this is rubbish. Like, you can't, no, it's the best. Right? Now, the question of cost is another point. But why would you say you can't have it until the evidence tells you you can't? You don't just announce it and then say, right, here's £9 billion to build it. You announce it and then you go through a series of gateways that become increasingly expensive. But you only go to the next gateway if the previous one says yes. Well, so far, all the gateways have said yes. Technically, it's deliverable. Financially, it's deliverable. We haven't reached a no gateway. And yet already, it is what it is because we are where we are. The city's talked itself out of a mass transit system when everything has said yesterday. I find that quite surprising and absolutely remarkable. And not only that, but it became a political liability for me to be advocating for a mass transit system. In a recent selection, I was told not to talk about mass transit, even though I'm talking about getting the best. London opened its up in 1863, right? I mean, why could we not have it? that has been a surprise. But we've pushed through, again, the arena. Now we've got one of the best arenas in Europe and probably the world coming. You know, Temple Court are coming through. 10,000 homes, 22,000 jobs, one of the biggest regeneration schemes in Europe. This new University of Bristol campus, like I said, Channel 4 earlier on. We've got some of the ambition going, and I hope that as things land, the city will begin to believe in itself a bit more, in its ability to get good things.
Because the skyline of Bristol is now a sea of cranes, which is the ultimate stamp of a place that's going somewhere. You talked about the pipeline of projects that are in play. To sort of wrap up, to leave time for questions, what are your hopes for Bristol? What do you wish for this city?
So we talk about hope a lot in my time, and I will be to tell you, I've always been fascinated by this word of hope, right? Because I think I prefer it to optimism. Desmond Tutu made this point. I find optimism quite superficial, but hope is profound, and I like hope because it grapples with suffering. There's a proverb that says, we don't despise our suffering. Suffering produces perseverance, perseverance, character, character, hope. And so I like the grittiness of hope in that. So my hope for Bristol is that it continues to be ambitious. It realises what it's managed to do and continues to be ambitious. But it's the right kind of ambition. Not one that sees money racing off over the hill, but an ambitious to be inclusive and sustainable. And I hope that it can continue to attract the investment that's needed. One of my least favourite phrases that is sometimes thrown at me and was thrown at me in the chamber is, Marvin, get this done. All it takes is political will. No. Political will and billions of pounds. Right? You can have all the will you want. If you can't pay for it, it ain't happening. So Bristol needs to be in a position in which it can communicate that ambition, it can communicate credibility to attract, for example, the £16 billion we think it needs to takes to decarbonise the economy, the hundreds of millions of pounds it's going to take to build 50,000 homes that we need for our city's future, and a city that is willing to face up to the fact that no solution comes without a price to be paid. The skyline has to change if we solve the housing crisis. The alternative to a skyline not changing is either urban sprawl or no building, right? So we have to come to terms with the fact that solutions cost.
And finally, this really is the final question from me. You've worked in journalism, you've worked in the charitable sector, you've worked in Britain and the United States, you've worked in politics. You already have a long CV. What's next for you?
I have a chaotic CV. Not long.
That was my polite way of saying that.
Yeah. Because I actually wanted to be a BBC foreign correspondent. And, you know, I was there with you back at the time, and it just, you know, they didn't like the way I spoke on TV, they didn't like the way I sounded on radio, but let's not get into that. I'm opening a door back on that one. Why am I in politics? I have said quite often that being mayor wasn't the aim. Being mayor is another manifestation of what I've wanted to do, which is try and make the world better. And escape poverty, by the way. I'm not shy about that. I was on radio once, and they said, you're just trying to make sure you're all right when you leave office. And I said, of course I am. You think I want to be poor? I've been poor. It's not good. I want to take care of friends and family, and I want to continue to do stuff that matters. It is going to be in the area of cities and city finance and decarbonisation and housing and city design. And we'll see what channel that is, whether it be political or otherwise.
Thank you very much. We've got about 10 minutes left for questions. We have some roving mics. I can see you now. Please do raise your hand to ask some questions, and we'll get a mic to you. And if you could be brief, if possible. We have a lady there in the centre. Is that a pink scarf? We'll get a mic to you.
Good evening, everyone. I'm the High Sheriff of Bristol. My name is Sharon Foster. My question is, we've got a lot of cranes in Bristol. We also want to see a lot of cranes with our young people. So, and at the moment in Bristol, there's a lot of things happening with young people and knife crime. So we want to shine a light on them. So what are we going to do about our young people to be recognized and to be listened to? Thank you.
Thank you.
So one of the points I have to make is actually there's a lot of stuff happening around young people in the city. I did an interview not too long ago, and someone said nothing is happening for young people and on knife crime. I said that's actually not true. There's loads of stuff, right? Empire Fighting Chance, Des Brown, Sari are doing stuff. Mario, who runs the Trojan Free Fighters at the bottom of the M32, has knives presented to him. So there are people doing things, right? Our challenge is, are the individual things that are happening as joined up as they need to be? And are we tackling the underlying pressures that increase vulnerability of people, the increase of vulnerability of people becoming perpetrators and victims? And they're often both, they're both two things at the, you know, at the same time. We have Amari here as well, as like from Creative Power Town as well. And I think what the way we've taken is a public health approach to that, which is looking at the wider determinants. So quality housing, good education. I know you're looking at school exclusions. I had a young person in my office the other day, 17 years old, grew up in a care system, is basically now has been arrested, but is very vulnerable to becoming a victim again. And you look back for the story, excluded from school at 13. What did we do at that point when the behaviour started to happen? Do we say this is a sign of vulnerability that we need to get onto? Do we say, right, you're out, now you're on your own, your life's in chaos and limbo, make your own way? Unfortunately, the structures around people are not often restorative structures that bring them back into positions of hope and see their potential. They then become seen as perpetrators and problems that we need to kind of carve off of society. They do end up back in society additionally vulnerable and potentially perpetrators again, which is a problem for us. So I think our drive is about building that inclusive society that looks at those underlying drivers. But it's complex. And we're never going to, it's Sisyphus, is it, right? We're never going to solve and eliminate risk, but we can reduce the pressures, I hope.
Thank you. There's a gentleman here on the, if we get the mic, there in the third row.
By the way, my son just shouted up on stage, dissing my socks.
Hiya, it's Kelvin Blake here. Marvin, right, so what's your hope for the Labour government? What do you hope that the Labour government will deliver And what advice would you give Keir Starmer?
There's a strong presumption underpinning that question. But
I could say look at your selections process, but I won't go there. Look, there's loads of things it can do. But as a city leader, one of the things that we've pointed out is that we are now in an urban world, right? This is the age of the city. Most of the world now live in cities. Right? Cities offer phenomenal potential. It's their density, their dynamism, and their diversity. So the density of cities offer unparalleled opportunities to increase the efficiency of human life, which reduces the amount of resources required to sustain each human life, right? We're not tapping into that. So if we do urbanisation right, we can reduce the harm a growing world population has, the toll it has on the planet. That's not being done at the moment. The sheer numbers of people living in cities mean as well, if you want to make stuff happen, talk to city leaders, because most people live in cities in the UK and around the world. So you can reach more human lives more quickly through cities than you can through other forms of human organisation. That's the way of making policy real. So my hope, among other things, is that what Keir will do is look at a major reset of the nature of the relationship between Westminster and local government in general, city leadership in particular. And think about the nature of finance. As I shared, not only is finance not enough, I'm not expecting Keir to open up the gates, and they've made that clear, but you can look at things like changing the short-term nature of finance. I don't know if you realise that so much of local government is competitive. We have to put a team together to bid for money that we might not get. If we don't get it, then we spent loads of money and loads of time bidding for that money. The leader of Birmingham a couple of years ago said this around the second round of levelling up. It's about £20,000 they spent, right? We spend loads bidding for money. We're like a voluntary sector organisation sometimes with national government. That needs to change. And we need a long-term view on cities, not just 2-3 year rounds. We need a 20-year view of where we need Bristol to be and other cities in 20 years. And plan on that high scale, because then we've got the housing pipeline, the transport solutions. So if Keir can plant a long-term vision for cities, I think we'd go a long way to unlocking so much potential and tackling so many challenges in the UK.
Thank you very much. We probably have time for just one more question. That lady there was very fast.
Marvin, on reflection, do you have any regrets or anything that you could have done differently?
That's a good question.
That's not really a fair question as well, is it? Because having just had a chat about journalism, you know it's going to be the headline tomorrow, right? there are regrets, I think. Some of them aren't that deep, but they're quite significant about how I would do things differently. I came in, and so I went to New York just after I was elected, and I met Michael Berkovitz. He was head of the Rockefeller Foundation, Resilient Cities. Michael had worked for Mike Bloomberg, and I was out with Mike. I was feeling a bit overwhelmed. He said, Marvin, he said, no, that's normal. He said, our first year in office, it felt like having our mouths around a fire hydrant. I thought, if this guy was with Mike Bloomberg and they felt like that, it's okay for me to feel like that. And I think that tsunami of decisions and pressures and things that seem to have been saved up from before the election landing on me caused me to squeeze the time I probably would have should have invested in visiting other city leaders and seeing how they structure themselves and how they do things. So we just got straight on the treadmill. Bam, right, you've got to do this, got to do that. And that was a challenge. I think I would have been more structured in my time. Rather than just bouncing off of what came in, I should have said, this is my time to be in the gym, this is my time to do this at home, and so forth. I'm not very good at building structure, which is a problem, and I should have done that, you know, at the beginning, made life a lot more predictable around me. In terms of issues in the city, that's what you're really asking, right? Where do I now find myself on the side of an argument I wish I didn't have? That's a difficult one, because it's not as though there are any overt failures. It's stages of, you know, it's degrees of success that we've dealt with. So do I think I wish we'd have seen sooner that some of the changes we wanted to happen within the council weren't actually being implemented. Right? I won't mention the departments, but there are some. There are delivery and there are impacts and there are services that were being delivered in a different way. If the piece of work we commissioned at the beginning had actually been done, and people hadn't been pretending to have done it, and I wish we'd have had a tighter grip on that.
Marvin Rees, thank you very much for answering all our questions. Thank you all for coming here this evening. I'm going to wish you the best for the future, and I'm wishing you all a good evening. If you can, please join us for drinks at the Western Bar here at Bristol Beacon. Your wristband that we attached to your wrist as you came in will get you access. And there we can continue the conversation about Bristol and about Marvin's time as mayor. Thank you very much.
Thank you.